If you have a Bible, if you want to open with me to 2 Kings chapter 17. Now, is it too low or can everybody hear me okay? Yes, the sarcasm runs thick through Eastgate. 2 Kings chapter 17. Now, if you remember the story so far, we've been looking at all through 2 Kings, the different kingdoms, the difference between the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. Southern kingdom who somewhat obeyed the Lord and stayed with the Lord's commands and with the covenant that God made with Israel when they first came in as a united kingdom. But remember, there'd been a split after Solomon, who was the last king of the unified kingdom. And the northern kingdoms, the northern tribes had gone off and started their own kingdom with their own religion. And so we were looking at the various kings that were over them. And that's basically what we've been going through, just going back and forth between the kings who've been over Israel since the time of David and since the time of Solomon. Last time we were looking at Ahaz, who was the king of Judah, and he was one of the first kings of the southern kingdom to really go astray. I mean, to really begin to get off track and introduced idolatry, and so we were looking at some of the effects of that on the southern kingdom and all. And we had been looking at the northern kingdoms, going through a series of about five kings specifically, who went in rapid succession after each other, none of them staying on the throne very long, all of them doing evil. So we're going back up to the northern kingdom one final time tonight as we start chapter 17. If you're there already, let's read the first four verses. We'll begin with that. It says, "In the 12th year of Ahaz, the king of Judah," that's in the southern kingdom, "Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal, and he paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done the year before. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison." Okay. Hoshea is the guy who led a conspiracy against the former king of the northern kingdom, Pekah. I don't know if you guys remember all of this. You know, it kind of gets a little confusing, and it's hard to keep up with all the different kings and all their goofy names and all the different ways in which they get stabbed and taken out of office. And so this is just one of the string of bad kings that there were at that time. So he took the throne through assassination. He's described as being evil. But he's also described as not being the most evil kings of the kings before him. And we're going to be reading, because as you noticed, I said this is our final time of looking at the kings of the northern kingdom. We're going to be reading about the judgment that comes on the northern kingdom, the final judgment that actually takes this kingdom out. And, you know, as we look at that, we wonder about that a little bit. Some of us could look at this and think, you know, if this king wasn't as bad as the other kings, if this one wasn't that bad, why is it that God's judgment comes during his reign? I mean, it would make more sense for God's judgment to come during the time of Ahab or some of these other kings who were so terrible and so wicked that did all these awful things. And the only thing that I can think of is that we're told in Peter that God holds back his judgment so that as many as can be saved will be saved. That's the basic tenor of the passage, the basic idea of it. That God in his mercy wants to make sure that everybody who's going to be rescued can be rescued. And so he's long-suffering. He'll wait a long time before allowing judgment to come on a nation or upon a people, like as in the case of these guys here. And so we have to look at it that way, in the sense that God was long-suffering during the time of Ahab. And even though this king wasn't as bad, you know, it's not the final blow of the axe that causes the tree to fall down. It's all the other blows before it. It's all the other times that the Israelites had sinned against God that mounted up so that the final straw was just this guy as he steps into place and continues the same legacy that had gone before him. None of them repenting, none of them all of them repeating the same evil, none of them repenting of it. So, once again, we see that the northern kingdom becomes a vassal state to the Assyrian Empire. During this period of history, we know from the archaeological records, the Assyrian Empire was gaining strength. And we call it the Neo-Assyrian Empire because there was an earlier one, but this is the one we have the most records of. And it was beginning to take over all of that region over there. I mean, it was flexing its muscle and expanding its power. Now, Shalmaneser was the son of Tiglath-Pileser, and I don't know if you remember him or not, but he was the one who was causing trouble for the king before this guy. And it seems as though Hoshea thought that this was a strategic time to begin resisting the push of the Assyrian Empire, because obviously we've got a change of leadership here. Last time we were looking at Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser was their leader, and now we've got a different one. His son is taking the throne. And oftentimes, in this transition between leadership, in this transition between kings, things can get unstable. Well, look at our own country right now. Every time we come up to an election year, what happens? The economy goes crazy. We all run around like chickens with our heads cut off. The sky is falling. It's just one of those things that happens. It happens in any kind of kingdom, and that's what's happening here. There is this transitionary period here where it looks as though Hoshea thought that this was a strategic time to go ahead and resist the Assyrians. And so he looks to form an alliance with Egypt in this resistance. Now, Egypt, we know from the archaeological record, was strong in its opposition. They were one of the foremost opponents to the Assyrians at that time. And so he must have looked at them and maybe struck a deal with them and felt pretty confident about this alliance that he created, because he quits paying rent. He stops payment on the check, and all of a sudden it causes them to become the focus of the Assyrian might, and it doesn't go too well for him because he lands up in an Assyrian prison cell for his efforts. And so things are not going well for the northern kingdom at this point. That's a bad sign when your leader, when your king, is immediately taken captive and thrown into jail. Well, who's minding the store then? So verse 5, now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. So here we see that they begin a 3-year siege. After they take the king prisoner, they go in and invade, and obviously you've still got a military strength in place, and so they're going to resist. They had strong walls around the city of Samaria, which we can see it took 3 years, but it tells us that the Assyrians had resources and commitment to carry out a 3-year siege and still maintain an empire, so clearly Israel was way outmatched in this scenario. So rebelling against the Assyrian Empire clearly was not one of the smarter things that this king had done. It turned into one of the very bad ideas of all of history. So we know that this was around 722 BC, and in that time frame, somewhere in the 720s to 713, the walls of Samaria get breached. We don't know exactly how it works, but the archaeological records we have from that region tell us the same story that the Bible tells us here. And the Assyrian armies flood into Samaria, and they destroy the armies of the northern kingdom, and they carry off all the people that are there. And the northern kingdom is completely conquered. Now, what they would do, and that's what we see described here, what they would do, an ancient kingdom like this, when they would go into another kingdom and conquer it, is they would carry out this mission of depopulation and exile. In other words, they take all the people who were formerly part of that country that could create a problem for them later down the line, and they exile them. They split them all up. You know, when you were in grade school and you had your best buddy sitting beside you and you're always making trouble, maybe you weren't like that, but I would always get separated from my good friends. We were, you know, when we were throwing erasers or whatever. And so to keep the Israelites from throwing erasers anymore, they split them all up and they sent them off to different parts of the Assyrian Empire, sent them off, and that's the whole idea. They're going to depopulate the area to keep it under control, make it easier to manage, and then they're going to exile the people who were formerly part of that, and that's exactly what happens here. They're going to go all over the place in the Assyrian Empire. And what's interesting, it's usually the upper class people, the lower classes, the lowest of the social strata in terms of you know, upper class to lower class. The lower classes were kept in the region. They were allowed to stay there, but the upper class people would be taken off and turned into slaves throughout the empire, and that's exactly what's happening here. And the Prisms of Sargon II record this siege, if you're ever interested in looking that up on the internet sometime. So we're looking at this. There's 200 years. It's been 200 years since Solomon's reign. And he was like the last king, as we said, the last king who ruled over a unified Israel. 200 years and 19 kings later, we find what's happening here. They're absolutely destroyed. They're overrun by their enemies, and they're exiled from the promised land that God gave them way back before when Moses led them out of Egypt. And you look at this and you wonder about it. You realize from all the things that we've read leading up to this point, it wasn't because God wasn't able to save them. It wasn't because God, you know, was overpowered by the Assyrian army and wasn't able to come through. Really, what it is that they no longer followed, and really, they no longer believed in God. They had a desire to serve something else that wasn't God, and it continued on, and God warned them, and God tried to stop them. God tried to turn them around, but they wouldn't turn around, and so God, at one point in time, stepped aside and gave them what they wanted, allowed them to have what they were absolutely determined to have. And the devil got his due in that whole scenario. Ooh, we got to be so careful of the things we wish for, the things we want, because wouldn't it be horrible to get it? Just like that, you think about this, in a few years' time, 3 years of a siege that encamped around Samaria, when the end of that 3 years came, all of that history, all of those tribes, all of that heritage of the Jewish people of the northern kingdoms, just disappears. Vanishes into Assyrian captivity. It's amazing. Never to really be seen again like they were before. Not to say that they're the lost tribes per se. I know that's a common phrase that we use, but it's somewhat of a misnomer, because we have to remember that we know from the earlier parts of the text, the Levites, those who were involved in the priesthood and all, had gone to the southern kingdom already, so those tribes are still intact to that degree. You've got to figure that some of the people who are carried off into Assyria are going to maintain some semblance of their own national heritage. We would have found pockets of Jewish settlements, people who were trying to maintain, you know, what they had held to before, or maybe even in repentance somewhere along the way. There were people, you know, the schools of the prophets, the sons of the prophets who were living in that region, who obviously would have been following God, who would have been carried away in this. I'm sure they would have maintained some semblance of their own national heritage. But in the sense of these tribal groups with the tribal demarcations within the territory there of the northern kingdom, that was gone for good. Now, I'm not someone who believes in the lost tribes in the sense that you've got this Anglo-Israeli concept that, you know, they somehow set sail across and ended up in England or something nonsensical like that. I believe they're, you know, they were all around in that area. And I think a lot of them probably ended up just getting assimilated. You know, so many of them obviously didn't care that much for the Lord, didn't care that much about their heritage, and so it would have been easy enough just to assimilate into the kingdoms that they'd been taken to, into the exile that they went into. So that is the end of the northern kingdom. All this time, all that we've been looking at has led up to this point, and now they're gone. All the warnings, all the prophecies, all of that, all the promises that preceded them when God brought them out of Egypt, now it's all gone. And so now the rest of the chapter is going to be outlining the reasons why this happened. It's basically going to, you know, the fundamental reasons of what transpired here, why this took place. So let's read verses 7 and 8. "For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And they had feared other gods, and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel, and all the kings of Israel which they had made." So the fundamental reasons why Israel fell are expounded on by the narrator here, and he begins remembering by remembering the reason that they were a nation in the first place. He was saying, he brings that whole thing up, that God brought them out of Egypt. The whole reason that they existed, the whole reason that there was a northern kingdom to begin with, is because God had delivered them from slavery. God had brought them out with miracles and amazing deeds and wonders, and gave them all these promises and just said to them, stick with me, hang out with me. Don't go chasing off after anybody else. Hang with me and I'll give you all this stuff. And so he goes back to that. The fundamental reason why this happened is they forgot who they were. But worse than that, they forgot the God who had made them who they were in the first place. They forgot who they were, and they forgot who God was in the process. And, of course, that's mankind's problem when you think about it. I've said that before. I mean, most of our problems boil down to identity crisis. We forget why we're here on this planet. We don't remember. And I mean, talking about in the general editorial sense of the world and its ways, mankind doesn't remember why we're here. We've forgotten the God who created us, the very reason why we exist to begin with. So their first sin was to forget the one who made them a nation. And he was so far from their memory that they began to fear other gods. And this, of course, is the basis for all sin, to leave off of God's ways and follow after our own ways or any other way that we decide is going to be more important than God. Any sin, because we use that term all the time, we throw that term around a lot, sin. You know, oh, sin, be careful, don't go sin. But what is sin? I mean, what are we talking about when we say sin? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about choosing our way, choosing some other way than God's way. Well, then how are you going to know what sin is? Well, we're going to find out what God's way is. We're going to get into his word and see what he's revealed. And from looking at his word and understanding that, we get a context for how we make life choices and the ways in which we go, where we place our loyalties, who we give our love to. That's what that's all about. Sin originates from that very concept, that core concept of I'm going to go some other way than the way that God devised for me. I'm going to serve something else than God. I'm going to follow my will, and I'm not going to follow God's will. And that is the basis for all sin. So they followed after other gods. They accepted the practice of the people who didn't know God like they knew. So they began being influenced by the pagan cultures around them instead of being an influence on them. They started adopting the ways of the pagan cultures around them, forgetting about God and his ways that he had devised for them. Okay, verse 9, and the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that weren't right. They built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger, for they served idols of which the Lord had said to him, "You shall not do this thing." So, not only, we look at this progress of their sin. They've forgotten God. They've forgotten why they're here. They're chasing after their own will and not serving God's will. They're being influenced by all of those who are in the process of doing that. They're not influencing anybody else anymore. And in their sin, in doing this, God suddenly became small, so that even in their religious practices, God was way too small in their thinking, because they thought they could secretly carry out some of these things and God wouldn't know about it. God was this religious creature who was way too small to know what was going on in their lives, and they began to see him just like the pagan gods, as being petty and finite in scope. So they move then from that, from just being secretly involved in practicing something that God didn't design in their religious practices, to where it becomes open then. Then on every high hill and on every fortified city, it doesn't even matter anymore. I'm just going to do what I want to do. I'm going to serve who I want to serve. I'm going to openly betray him because he means nothing to me anymore. He's small. He's an insignificant God. And so it's talking about the authorized paganism that was beginning to prevail in the nation of Israel, in the northern kingdom there. See, once we begin down that path of making God small and manageable, once we begin down that path of thinking that we're going to put on a religious front, some religious show that will fool God into thinking that we're okay, then all of a sudden we begin down a path that's going to take us to some extreme places of disobedience. We begin departing from him altogether. And Israel was religious while they did this. They didn't stop being religious. They were religious all the way through. It's just that their religion began to be tweaked, began to be corrupted, began to be turned into something that they could manage, that they could control, where they could call the shots, where their will would be done and not God's. And that's a dangerous place to be, as we can see from their example for us. Verse 13. For they, yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all his prophets, every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways I'm sorry, I left my, and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. Nevertheless, they wouldn't hear, but stiffened their necks like the necks of their fathers who wouldn't believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant. Rejected, that's a strong word. His statutes and his covenants that he had made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols. They became idolaters and went after the nations who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not be like them. So here we see this picture of in the process of their turning away, of their rejection of God, of their determination to go some other way. Here's this other picture of God calling out to them. And granted, when we think of the prophets and we hear all these things, we oftentimes have a tendency to kind of maybe think in terms of a condemning voice that comes in, that speaks about judgment. But we realize that what's implicit in every cry of the prophet is a call to them to turn. This is the sound of a grieving father calling out to his child, don't do this. Don't go that way. Don't go down that path. That's not going to lead to a good end for you. Turn back from that. But they determined they weren't going to. They absolutely refused. It uses a metaphor here of a stiffened neck. It's a metaphor of an ox and a cart and a stubborn animal who's determined. You know, he'd tighten up his neck, those thick cords in his neck to refuse to be turned by anyone trying to direct it in a different way. Now, the phrase when it says that they followed idols, became idolaters, it's much better in the literal language, and a lot of the newer translations actually do it better than the King James or the New King James. But literally, it says they followed emptiness or vapidity, and they became empty and vapid in the process. The whole idea is they were following something. The word literally means air, or it means delusion. It's something that's vain. So they followed after stuff that wasn't real. And, you know, you think about the life that maybe we used to live, the things that we chased after, that when we kept thinking, oh, if I could just have that, if I could just get that, if I could get my hands on that thing, or if I could just get that relationship, or if I could just get this or that or whatever it was, something to shoot salads into a bowl where I don't have to use my fingers, anything, you know, whatever it is that we think that we have to have, that, oh, if we could have it, we'd finally be fulfilled. And how many of us have known that sense of vapidity, that sense of vapor? Like you get this thing and then you're looking at it thinking, well, so what? This didn't do it. And then something else shiny catches our eyes and we chased after it. Oh, if I had that thing, that's what I want. And that's what was happening to Israel. That's what God's describing here. You were chasing after vapors. You were chasing after smoke in the wind. It was nothing. And I was right here, the real thing, calling out to you, trying to get you to hear my voice. And you wouldn't do it. You were determined to go some other direction. And so in the process, they become vaporous, vapid. They become like smoke, so much smoke that just disappears. And that's obviously what happened in the process. You get less a sense of God coming in, smacking people around, and more of this sense that God calls out to people who are determined to walk into a blazing furnace, determined to make a choice that was self-destructive in its conclusion. Verse 16, so they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molded image and two calves, made a wooden image and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire. They practiced witchcraft and soothsaying and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. And there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. Also, Judah didn't keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of the plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. For he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin, for the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They didn't depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from out of his sight, as he said by all his servants and prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. So while they're chasing the wind, while they're off trying to find some sort of sense of fulfillment or satisfaction in the stuff that constantly sifts through their fingers. God, like a parent longing to have them turn around to something meaningful, instead has to watch in horror as they become emptier and emptier. They move deeper into degradation, into witchcraft, it says, the very thing that God told them at the outset. Don't get involved in following after the thing that has its source in the wrong source of power. And they went off after idolatry, even to the point that is pointing out, you know, making their children pass through the fire, the idea of infant sacrifice that was prominent within certain pagan religions there. And finally, it became too late because, well, I mean, it was too late. I mean, we talk about God's grace. We do a lot because the Bible makes a huge emphasis, this huge emphasis about the grace of God, the long-suffering of God, how his love never fails, his love never ends. And so I'm prone to saying it's never too late. It's never too late when we factor in God's grace. And I'll still say it to this day. It's never too late until it's too late. And this is a situation where we see that very thing. It's never too late until it's too late. And what I mean by that is in this life that we live here, man, it's not too late. There's time. There's always time. There's always time to turn to the Lord. But from what we understand from this text, when this life comes to its conclusion, it's going to be too late. It's too late at that point. That's the time to turn is over. I mean, you know, from what we understand at this point, that's the cutoff point. That's the cutoff when this life has been concluded here. We have this life to turn to him, to receive his grace, to find our meaning and our purpose in him and who he is. But after that, then we're going to face, well, the wholeness of God in the sense of his justice as well. God is gracious and merciful, but God is just. And we never want to forget that reality. God is just. And we see that even in this example that is portrayed for us here. That's why it says to us today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts like Israel did. Like we see in this example here, don't harden your hearts. Don't stiffen your necks, but heed it and turn to him while it's today. That's the concept that's you know, presented to us there. Don't fall into that snare of Israel that they fell into. That's why Paul says that this was written down as an example for us. So while we'll emphasize grace until we don't have breath left in our lungs to say it, we want to always remember there's another side to this. There's another side. It's never too late until it's too late. Notice how it mentions that only the southern kingdom, Judah, was left, and it kind of even throws a backhanded compliment, like, yeah, and even they're not so hot when it comes to following the Lord. I mean, the writer seems to be feeling a little bleak when he's looking at the situation here, that they weren't even all that great when it came to God's covenants. Verse 24, then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Avah, Hamath, and from Sarepvaim, and he placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. And it was so, at the beginning of their dwelling there, that they didn't fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. And so they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, you know, the nations whom you removed and placed in the cities of Samaria don't know the rituals of the God in the land. Therefore, he sent lions among them. And indeed, they're killing them because they don't know the rituals of the God of the land. So the king of Assyria commanded, saying, well, send there one of the priests whom you brought from there and let him go and dwell there and tell him to teach them the rituals of the God of the land. And then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and he taught them how they should fear the Lord. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in shrines on the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashimah, and the Avites made Nibaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in fire to Adramelech and Aramelech, the gods of Sarah. And so they feared the Lord, and from every class appointed for themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines and the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away. Well, that's kind of weird, isn't it? The practice of depopulation and exile meant also that the territory that had now become vacant was going to be occupied by the citizens who were loyal to the empire that had now conquered that territory. So that's what's happening here. They're sending in all these Assyrian people who are going to go in, people who are part of the Assyrian Empire, going to go in and populate this region and take it over and resettle that place so that, you know, they can expand the income and resources of the Assyrian Empire. The problem in this scenario is lions. And it's a strange bit of text. Maybe, and there's several different theories as to how this goes. I mean, maybe the land had been sitting unoccupied for a long time. Maybe there was a lot of carnage left over, maybe a lot of slaughter of animals and people, and maybe the wild beasts and lions and people, not people, but animals like that had been moving into the area and scavenging there and gotten used to being there so that when people came in and tried to repopulate it, it was difficult to try to keep the wild animals at bay, which is, it's a possibility, except that the text also tells us that God sent the lions. So, you know, there's nothing very predictable about God. I mean, when it comes to how he's going to do stuff, you know, he obviously was bringing about his judgment through the hand of the Assyrians. And when the Assyrians go in there to take over, God sends them lions. I guess it's kind of the idea that, you know, I used you for this, but don't think that you're okay by this. It's not like I'm on your side in the practices that you're involved in. These were still my people. So their assumption is that this has to do with a territorial god. Remember, the pagan nations believed in territorial gods. We saw that one time, the gods of the hills, the gods of the valleys, that whole kind of concept, and that's what is presented here. The assumption is made that, well, the god of that territory requires certain practices that we're not aware of, and so he's sending lions to go get us. And so they get the Shalmaneser's solution is to get the experts on religion in there and get them doing the stuff that's going to appease the territorial god and get rid of the lions. And so they send a priest in there who teaches them about the God of Israel, which, when you think about this, this is kind of fascinating, really. I mean, you know, here are these pagan people who have moved into this territory, Gentiles, who know nothing about God, have had no history with God whatsoever, but when they get in there, because the kitty cats are pretty mean, they get a priest who comes in and begins to teach them about the God of Israel. All of a sudden, they're being exposed to the reality of the one true God because of the result of what happened here. And I think that's kind of neat. I think that's a cool concept. But it also tells us a little bit about motives and stuff, because we see that their practice of these rituals was quite half-hearted. I mean, even though it says that they feared the Lord, in other words, they respected him, they had a healthy respect for God because of what was happening there, the fear of lions was really the only thing motivating them to go ahead and do this, and there wasn't anything relational to back the whole thing up. There wasn't any capacity to be wholehearted in following this God. This was just to get the lions off of their backs. And you know, I think there's something really important in all of that, because we see that they move on to the former practices that they had. They continue worshiping what they had worshiped before. They give a nod to the man upstairs, you know, but they're going to continue on serving materialism or serving money or entertainment or their lust or whatever it is, whatever idol that they desired to follow, whatever it was that was part of their plan, according to their will, that they wanted to practice. And, you know, it's a pretty good description of a lot of people today. A lot of people will have a certain capacity for acknowledging that, sure, there's a God, there must be a creator. I'll show up at a church now and anon. I'll, you know, throw a couple dollars in an offering bucket just to get him off my back, just to make sure that the lions don't get me. But really, I have no interest in being part of his plan or doing his thing. I'm going to follow my own way. And, you know, that brings me to another point that I think is an interesting possibility. That a lot of times we'll hear people say that the doctrine of hell, or the preaching of the doctrine of hell, is a powerful tool when it comes to evangelism. I don't know if you've ever heard that kind of concept before, but I come into contact with that a lot of times. I mean, I'm a lot of times in conflict with other people, other pastors and stuff, because I don't necessarily ascribe to that notion. The idea being that, well, if you don't tell people about hell, they're not going to know how important it is to repent and to turn aside from that. But I noticed from this that a fear of lions only gets you just a small bit of commitment, just enough to get the lions off your back so that you can continue on with your own plans and your own purposes. I'm not so convinced that just a horror story about the flames of hell are going to be resulting in deep commitments to God and a desire. You know, when the Word says it's His kindness that leads to repentance, I'm inclined to think that there needs to be more to it than just getting eternal fire insurance as a means of getting religion in the whole thing. I think that there's something deeper that's needed here. These guys came in contact with the living God. They were faced with real lions, and the priests came and told them how God should be feared. And so they did that stuff, but they really didn't do it with their hearts. There wasn't any real determination to follow Him. It was just looking for a means of keeping safe from the kiddies. All right, verse 34. To this day, they continue their practice of the former rituals. They don't fear the Lord, nor do they follow the statutes. And when it says they don't, well, I'll get to that. They don't fear the Lord, they don't follow the statutes or the law and the commandment which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom He named Israel, with whom the Lord had made a covenant and charged them, saying, "You shall not fear other gods, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." I lost my place. "But the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and an outstretched arm, with Him Him you shall fear, Him you shall worship, and to Him you shall offer sacrifice. And the statutes and ordinances of the law and the commandment which He wrote for you, you shall be careful to observe forever. You shall not fear other gods. And the covenant that I've made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods, but the Lord your God shall you fear. And He'll deliver you from the hand of all your enemies." However, they didn't obey, but they followed their former rituals. So these nations feared the Lord, yet served their carved images. Also their children and their children's children have continued doing as their fathers did even to this day. So that area of the northern kingdom and Samaria was noted then for this strange mixture of pagan idolatry and the practices of Judaism. And this mixed religion, and ultimately a mixed race of people who blended with the remaining Israelites who were in that area, the lower class people, were still there in the time of Jesus when He was teaching in that region in the New Testament, which is why we can understand from the separatist point of view why the Pharisees, why the Jewish people who were separatist in their thinking were so offended with Samaria, and why it's so amazing that Jesus uses them in such positive examples. You know, the parable of the Good Samaritan, it was completely scandalous in that day, because you see the history, you see where they came from. To think that Jesus is expanding His inclusion of people to even include them, revealing that the values of the kingdom have nothing to do with race or former religious practices, but have everything to do with a heart made into a temple where God resides, was what it was all about. So the writer concludes all of this by stating that the northern kingdom, if it had been faithful, even moderately faithful, would have probably been there to that day. That would have stood against their enemies. God would have delivered them. But God stepped out of the way of their enemies when they refused to follow Him, and they were destroyed as a result of that. Now, verse 41 could seem confusing because verse 34 says they don't fear the Lord, and yet verse 41 says that they do fear the Lord. But the idea in that first sense was the idea of respect in order to gain an immediate result, the deliverance from lions. But the other aspect, that they didn't fear the Lord, I mean, the final one is the respect to get rid of lions. But the first one, they didn't fear the Lord, was in that sense of a relational, wholehearted loyalty to God. They didn't have that. They were just practicing certain things in a superstitious, religious kind of way. So they had respect for God, but it was limited. And they were still following their own path, merely trying to appease God with certain behavioral modifications and codes of religion, which of course is never the biblical way. Any time that we get ourselves into a practice of religious performance or behavioral modification, thinking that that's the means by which we're going to please God, we're falling right back into the same snare that the Samaritans had fallen into, of thinking that God would be appeased if we do certain things here, when all the while God's looking for our hearts. God has all the time wanted to recapture our hearts and make his dwelling place there. So we'll pick up there next time. Father, we thank you for your word. And Lord, while we see this, we step back with a level of reverence, recognizing that you are God, and that in all the affairs and all the events that unfold for us in this world, you're in charge, you're in control. Father, I just pray for each of us here this evening that our hearts are willing to serve you and follow you, that we don't have any kind of false religious notion of who you are, that we don't allow you to become small in our thinking, someone that we can control or manipulate or cause to do what we want instead of bending us to your will. Father, I just pray that you soften all of our hearts, that our necks aren't stiffened, but our hearts are soft to follow you and serve you, to repent where necessary, and to remember in all these things that it's your love that leads us on. It's your love that determined to rescue us and save us. When mankind fell, Lord, you could have dismissed us. You could have eradicated us with a thought. But instead, you sought us out to love us, to rescue us, to bring us home to you. So keep our feet securely on that path. Guide our steps to you. Keep our hearts firmly tethered to the throne of grace. I pray that you do that for us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Any questions or comments or anything about tonight?